Hi, this is Katie.
This is Chelsea.
I'm Lindsay.
I'm Candace.
And this is
Hanging with my Chromies.
So Hanging with my Chromies is all of us sitting together talking about chromatography and how many cool things that it's produced in our lives. So today we're going to be talking about the first biologic that has saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Can you guys guess what it is?
Can you give us a little clue?
Ooh, I have one. Dogs.
How about another clue?
So, how about it helps regulate blood sugar?
Oh, that's better.
Oh, totally got this. Insulin?
Yep. Today we're going to talk about insulin and how it's really cool. And everybody should know it.
So you want to talk about insulin today, but I'm not a diabetic, so why should I care about insulin?
Well, we all know that insulin allows the body to regulate blood sugar, but did you know that insulin has furthered the areas of research in multiple different fields? Not only that, two Nobel Prizes have been awarded on insulin research, but are separated by 30 years.
What are the Nobel Prizes for?
Hold on. Let's take a step back and let's start at the very beginning. So research on diabetes and discovering the insulin has been going on for many, many years. In fact, there is, there's stuff in Egypt, which I can't think of what. There's evidence that Egyptians actually did insulin research. But in the 1880s is whenever things really started to gain steam. So in the late 1800s, European researchers discovered that if they remove the pancreases of dogs, that they start to have sugar in their urine. And the way that they figured that out is that flies were actually attracted to the urine. And if they were humans, the researchers actually would have tasted the urine.
Oh, that is very disturbing.
Yeah, the standards of research were a little bit different in the 1880s.
Definitely would not have signed up for that test.
But the real breakthrough happened in 1921. So there was a researcher. He didn't have any publications, but his name was Frederick Banting. And so he convinced a professor with a lab, J.J. McCloyd, to let him do research and basically take the extract of pancreas islets and put them back into dogs that didn't have pancreases. And so they were ligating the pancreas and then taking the extract and putting it back into dogs. Hmm. It took about a year to 18 months to really perfect this, but they were able to actually bring down the blood sugar in the dog. And so her name was Marjorie. And most of the dogs didn't survive very long, but they were actually able to keep her alive for 10 times the amount of time that they were able to keep the other dogs alive.
So what you're telling me is a dog and a non-traditional scientist are really who we have to thank for kind of kicking this thing off?
Yes, that is absolutely correct.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. He led a very interesting life. And there's lots of more things that we could talk about there, but let's stick with the insulin topic for now.
All right.
So the real test was, could they do this in humans? And so they joined forces with another researcher that was a biochemist who figured out that you could alcohol extract and precipitate the insulin and was able to make it pure enough for them to actually take and inject into humans.
Wow.
And so the first patient was a 14-year-old, and this was all done at the University of Toronto. And so it was a 14-year-old that was in the pediatric ward that had type 1 diabetes. The first injection didn't work so well because it wasn't quite pure enough, but the second injection worked and brought his blood sugar down to normal levels.
That must have been really exciting.
I can't imagine how excited they were because they immediately went and injected 6 more patients. So the rumor mill has it, but I wasn't able to confirm, that these 6 patients were on the pediatric ward and were basically comatose children. And so they went around and injected all 6 children with this new concoction that they had. And by the time that they were injecting the 6th child, the first child was waking up.
I can't imagine how, you know, kind of extraordinary that must have been to see in real time your solution working while still doing the study. That's really cool.
Yeah, I can't even imagine being the parents of those children and all of a sudden there's this miraculous substance that's able to save your child's life.
It speaks to how important this is even today.
Mm-hmm. It really is, because without insulin, type 1 diabetics wouldn't be able to survive.
So you mentioned that they were doing alcohol extraction. Is that still the technology that we're using today?
No. So alcohol extraction is a great way to get started on purification of a protein, but it's definitely not as rigorous and doesn't produce the purity as chromatography will do. So most of the time, there's a three-step process for purification of biologics, and that's how it's done with insulin. There's typically ion exchange steps followed by other chromatography methods that make it as pure as possible so that whenever the person gets the injection, it's the only thing that's in there.
And so the only thing they're purifying is insulin, or is there anything else involved?
So at the first, that's how it was, but they've made it to where there are other molecules that are going in it that are also biologics that make insulin either long-lasting or rapid-acting, depending on what that patient needs. So there's different treatments for type 1 diabetics than there is for type 2 diabetics.
So they really are looking to improve kind of even insulin, which is great as it is the revival drug. There is further improvement that can be done.
Mm-hmm. There is further improvement that can be done.
Wow, that's still exciting then.
It really is. And so I mentioned earlier that there was a Nobel Prize two Nobel Prizes that were given. The first was given to Banting and McLeod the year after they made this discovery, which is unheard of. So the very following year, because it was such a breakthrough, they got the
immediate recognition.
Yes, immediately.
Wow.
And the second one happened over 30 years later, was for sequencing the amino acid sequence of insulin.
Huh.
Can you guess who discovered that?
I can't.
So it was Frederick Sanger.
Sanger. Oh, okay.
So,
a name I think we've heard of.
Yeah, so he is pretty much known for figuring out the fact that you've got a DNA sequence that goes to a protein sequence, you know, the central dogma.
There you go with dogs again.
Insulin has been at the forefront of research in multiple different areas. And then once they actually sequence the protein, humans have one DNA sequence, cows another, pigs another. So once they actually sequenced it, they looked and compared it between those three species, and they were really lucky that they were using pigs and cows to generate the insulin for type 1 diabetics and type 2 diabetics.
What benefits did pigs and cows have?
Oh, it was because their pancreases were actually larger, so they were able to get more and more substance from the actual extraction method. So originally they were using dogs, which have a smaller pancreas than, say, a pig or a cow.
Okay, cool.
So whenever they actually sequenced the insulin, they figured out that humans and cattle only differ by one or three amino acids from the human insulin, meaning that they could do a direct substitution and it didn't have any deleterious effects in humans because it was so similar to what the human protein already was.
Wow. So did that kind of expedite their time to market and like how long the research took because it was so similar?
Probably. I mean, you can't say for sure, but I would think so because it's so similar. You're not having to figure out what species is the correct species to match. Insulin is just a highly conserved protein between a lot of different species, especially mammalians, as we can see.
It's interesting when we step back and we think about all the little details that kind of go into drug development like this and kind of how successful they were in this specifically for insulin.
It's almost like they hit the ball out of the park, right off the bat.
Hence the one-year Nobel Prize, kind of, right?
Yeah, I mean, that is completely unheard of. Now it takes, 15, 20 years to get a Nobel Prize, and then it was just because it impacted so many people immediately. I mean, so you have this small research lab at University of Toronto that's trying to make enough of this product that they basically couldn't. They had to partner with somebody, and so Eli Lilly, the company out of Indianapolis, stepped in and partnered with them to be able to scale up this process so that they would be able to purify enough to, send it worldwide.
Help more people.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. And then after Sanger sequenced the protein, then you were able to actually clone it into, say, bacteria or something like that to express lots and lots of it. Well, guess who was the first fledgling biotech that was able to bring a recombinant insulin to market?
Who?
Fledgling, small.
Small biotech.
It's down in South San Francisco.
I'm stumped.
Genentech.
Oh, that's small pharmaceutical company, Genentech.
Yeah, I didn't dig too deep into, like, if it was their first product or not, but it certainly sounds that way.
They've come a long way since then, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Another thing to note is the fact that it was one of the first proteins that had its X-ray crystallography structure solved.
Wow.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah. So there's a lot of firsts with insulin, it sounded like.
Mm-hmm. There really is. It's because it affected so many people, I think, because it, before we really understood it, I don't think we realize now, I mean, a lot of people realize that there's a lot of type 1 or type 2 diabetics out there, but the adverse effects of having that we don't see anymore because, you know, people would lose their feet or their hands because of the poor circulation. You know, we don't see that anymore and we don't think about it. But back then it was very prevalent because they didn't understand what was going on and why it was happening.
And insulin has just really helped lower the occurrences of some of those super negative effects of diabetes,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think we can all be thankful for that, whether we have it or not.
Very true.
It sounds like insulin had a major impact on looking into treatments for different diseases. What kind of effect have you seen it have on drug development as a whole?
I think because it was the first biologic, it really paved the way to open all these doors and kind of to set the precedence of what you need to do to be able to make a biologic, to understand the purities there, the effect is there, and understanding the pharmacokinetics and dynamics. I'm going to throw a lot of these words out there, but that there's a lot of things that you have to understand to be able to use it and move forward. And so they could take that and apply it to all these other different places.
So basically learning how to study insulin is teaching us how to learn how to study other biologics?
That's absolutely correct.
Wow.
And I mean, not only that, it really taught us not just how to study other biologics, but how to study proteins in general. Understanding how they interact, how they have alcohol precipitation, salt precipitation. Like, there's lots of things that we learned from identifying and isolating this one molecule that has now spread to so many different areas. So insulin is the steam that drives the train of drug development forward.
Wow. I think, you know, we talked about all the details that kind of came up where they was really advantageous towards studying insulin. It sounds like all these details can be reflected upon by other scientists as they move forward and looking at different drugs for different diseases today.
Absolutely correct.
There's so much that I didn't know about insulin.
It's really cool!
That might have just blown out the speakers, but sorry, Blair.
So, Lindsay, what did you think of the interview that Katie and I did?
I thought it was really interesting, you know, just because so many people's lives are affected by diabetes and, you know, everybody in this room probably has someone, a family member that they know that's been affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was really interesting to hear the origins of how it got started and how it's kind of evolved. And now it's going beyond just helping people with diabetes, but now any biologic for multiple diseases are being studied using this method.
Yeah.
Did you guys notice how in the first episode we talked about the sugars in beer and then directly for the second episode now we're translating into insulin and kind of reversing those effects? I thought that was a pretty nice progression.
Yeah, that was a really interesting, very serendipitous.
Yeah.
I have a fun fact about beer and diabetes.
Oh.
Is that people would give their, I know that parents would give their children beer before bed. Because of the children that had diabetes.
I was like,
not all children, but children that had diabetes. Because of the sugar in the beer. And that would keep the kids, or the parents would be kind of reassured that the kid wouldn't have a reaction at nighttime because now they
had
overloaded
sugar.
With sugar.
Little blood sugar, sugar spike.
Okay, that's interesting. I never heard that before.
Yep.
Noted.
So, Chelsea, I really wanted to find out a little bit more about the urine analysis. That was, like, actually a really interesting fact in the beginning of your story.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. So, for human patients, they would actually taste the urine of the patients to try and figure out if the children were diabetic or not, because there would be lots of sugar in the urine.
Well, my mother, she was diagnosed with diabetes when she was 3, and my grandparents actually figured it out because she would wet the bed, and in the morning when they would go to wake her up, her sheets were all sticky and crunchy because of the sugar in the urine.
So it's really interesting that, you know, we all know someone that has diabetes, but to have such a direct relationship with someone that has the illness, and that what held true in the 1800s still held true even for your mom. It's very interesting, but at the same time, something that someone that doesn't have diabetes or know someone that directly has diabetes, it's just very interesting to me. Like, it's a piece of information and really makes you sensitive to the fact of, you know, the differences in people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah.
So you mentioned how Genentech was one of the first manufacturers of insulin, and you mentioned this small little pharma company.
Yeah, so Genentech was one of the first manufacturers of recombinant insulin once they had the ability to clone it into other organisms versus, you know, grinding up pancreases from other animals. Yes.
Okay. And then you also mentioned how there's these additives that they're putting into insulin either to make it longer lasting or time release or something like that. Is Genentech still developing further insulin, or are they selling what they had, you know, way back in the 1800s, early 1900s, whenever that was going on?
So Genentech really got started in the either late 60s or early 70s is whenever this project took off.
1960s and 70s.
Did I say 18?
No.
I don't even know.
That's your good sound.
So Genentech got started in the late 1960s and early 1970s on this project. I'm sure that they're still doing research on it. I have a friend from grad school, shout out to UT Southwestern, Josh, who was actually working on looking at understanding metabolism in mice. So that's still ongoing projects that they have going on at Genentech. Yeah.
Great.
In terms of, you know, manufacturing and processing insulin, like, where does chromatography play a part in any of that today?
Yeah. So chromatography is still, you know, the way to, you know, purify a molecule to homogeneity. So making sure that insulin is that only, you know, the only thing in that vial whenever you inject it. And so they're still using chromatography steps, whether that's ion exchange or capture. Well, actually, you wouldn't. Yeah, typically it's going to be an ion exchange media, which means that you're using the charge of the insulin to be able to purify its homogeneity.
It sounds like that would have helped them early on when they injected that first patient without having a completely pure sample.
Yeah. And that was so. Really, there's a lot of history that we didn't get into that I didn't want to dive too deep, but there was actually a lot of drama.
Yeah. Probably a lot of contamination.
No. Not even about the contamination. It was just drama between the people that discovered this. So McLeod, I think that's how you say his name, and Banting, like, had this huge
rivalry?
Blowout. Kind of a rivalry. Like, Banting, because he wasn't really a scientist. He was very... I'm going to repeat what I read. He was basically very insecure about his scientific work and would try and like own things that really would limit the actual progress of research, where McLeod would try and bring other people in.
Collaborative,
exactly. But Banting felt like McLeod was taking the project away from him, and that he was trying to say that it was his discovery and his lab and all of that. And so it was just, so there was just a lot of ego that went into this. And I think that Banting was just very, very, you know, insecure because he didn't have the background to really to back it up. Even though he had the grand idea and it really was his discovery. And even McLeod said that, you know, he wouldn't have worked on this project if it hadn't been for Banting just continually to go after him and just trying to, like, with his enthusiasm, make it to where he was interested in the project and let them work on it. But it was the use of the chemist, whose name escapes me right now, that was able to purify it using alcohol precipitation that was the second injection, was using his prep rather than Banting and Best's prep. And that was how they were able to inject and actually have good results that then exploded all around the world and had, you know, people trying to get access to how they were doing this and what they were doing.
So when was this research going on?
You mean what year?
Yeah.
So it was 1921, 22, and then they got the Nobel Prize the year after.
I mean, these days, sharing scientific breakthroughs is really easy and fast, right, through the internet. But I wonder how this kind of spread globally and how the message got to other countries or other people even.
Maybe conferences?
I don't know. I think, literally is people calling phone. But, I mean, we didn't have the internet back then, but...
I remember from a long time ago taking a class and reading how publications and journals, like especially in Europe, like in France, some of these journals were how information was shared, but it took so long to compile them that actually like developing and moving forward took a really long time. This sounds like such an exciting discovery.
Yeah, it was such an exciting discovery that people were picking up the phone and making calls.
That's great.
And just because it moved from different places very, very quickly, very rapidly. Once people, the word got out, and after it was published in newspapers, because it wasn't just, waiting for the written article to come out. It was being published in newspapers because it was such a breakthrough. Because any child with juvenile or type 1 diabetes, basically it's a death sentence because it's just, it's a matter of time. And for them to be able to go in and have something that basically is going to save this child's life, everybody was interested and everybody wanted that because, that's...
Yeah, I'd imagine.
So with the chromatography then for diabetes, do they start off doing gravity flow or what type of...
Yeah, they would have started with, gravity flow and probably, starting with pumps and being able to just monitor using like a chart recorder. To start off with, and then, as advancements in chromatography was made, then, I was looking at some papers that were, about how to purify from, the 1960s, and that was how it was done. And it was really whenever we understood the central dogma, to bring back the dogs in, that was whenever we actually made the advancements of being able to mass scale produce it and it be, completely humanized. So when did Bio-Rad start doing chromatography?
Bio-Rad started actually with their focus on chromatography back in the 50s.
Yeah,
so,
the AG resins, right?
Exactly. So they started especially with these ion exchange resins that are still used today.
Yep.
Yeah.
They're legacy specialty resins.
Yeah.
So they've been around since the very beginning.
Yeah, which is pretty cool.
Yep.
So chromatography was invented in 1903 by a Russian botanist.
That was actually from Poland, right? Though there's somebody said that. We kept saying Poland.
Mikhail?
Yeah, Mikhail. Yeah.
Mikhail.
Yeah.
And he was doing plant pigments on a calcium carbonate column.
I guess when you're trying to purify insulin, why is ion exchange like an ideal technique?
Okay, so nowadays a lot of the biologics are antibody-based, right? And the way that they purify antibodies is through using protein A for the most part. Protein A is a very expensive resin, but it does do really good selectivity. However, ion exchange is capable of capturing proteins in their native state, so without having any type of tag or using any type of affinity chromatography. And so because insulin, you don't want to have a tag on it, you don't want to have anything except for the amino acids that are there naturally.
You want to keep it functional.
You want to keep it functional and you want to keep it from having some type of immunologic response. And so because of that, you want to capture using the native properties, which would be charge, size or hydrophobicity, which ion exchange is great for that. Not only that, a lot of our resins for ion exchange are in the, how do I say this? They are designed with mass production in mind so that they have the flow characteristics that allow for both fast capture, fast transfer, and then also being able to use a column that's, the size of a person.
Mm-hmm. And it's really great because I think we all know chromatography and the focus of drug development before was largely small molecules in reverse phase. So now we have even more developments around resins and being able to keep the native properties of proteins and peptides with these more biologic focused resins like ion exchange.
And so a lot of advancements in chromatography happened in the 60s, but more recently there's been a move towards having dual functionality with resins. So what's either called mixed mode or mixed media. So say you have one protein that you're trying to purify, but it has, a post-translational modification so that it has charge variants, being able to tease out those differences and if it has an actual function or has the post-translation.
The
effect. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. What did you learn from this podcast? What did you take home?
That it was way easier to win a Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
Ouch, man.
I'm just kidding.
So let's go around and just talk about what it was the one thing that we found both interesting and that we would take away from this.
Yeah, I found it really interesting in terms of the progress over the years and just, you know, I mean, in terms of being able to help that many people and how it probably spurred a lot of purification techniques forward in terms of being adopted in a lot of labs. Yeah.
I didn't realize that dogs were actually, you know, was the first animal that was used on it. So that was pretty cute. But yeah, and then also, you know, all the methods that were used to help, you know, discover the protein and create the biologic. I mean, it's really cool to know that those methods now can be used for, it's like the standard for everything.
I may have missed it, but what drove Banting to want to purify insulin to begin with?
I think it was just, I don't know if that was a personal vendetta. They didn't say anything about that, about, you know, anyone in his life having diabetes. But it just, they mentioned that he had this epiphany in reading a paper and then couldn't sleep for several nights just thinking about, like, how he could take, you know, this extract, you know, ligate these pancreatic cells and then take the extract and then put them into dogs that, you know, didn't have a pancreas. Like, that was really what... where it started was just him kind of having this idea and just mulling it over in his head and thinking that he was onto something. Now, he wasn't the only one that had this idea. He was just the first one to make it work.
Got it.
So there was scientists around the U.S. And probably around the world as well that were working on this. He was just the first one that had the backing and the bandwidth to really get it to come full circle. So... one of the things that I'm going to take away from this, and I'm sure that I read this in my biochemistry book whenever I was, you know, in college, but just the fact that Sanger, who we all know for Sanger sequencing, was the person that actually sequenced the protein molecule. Like, that's one of the things that I think is just really cool and something that I'm never going to forget. You know, you go to college and you learn all these things and then you forget them as, you know, time goes by, but that's something that I was just like, oh yeah, that's really, it's really interesting and really cool, the fact that he had such an effect on so many different areas of science. Thanks for joining us today, and I hope that I've convinced you that insulin is really cool. Make sure and check out our other podcast at bioradiations.com, and don't forget to subscribe. Thanks for hanging with us.
This podcast is an original creation of Bio-Rad Laboratories. Bio-Rad is a trademark of Bio-Rad Laboratories Incorporated in certain jurisdictions. All trademarks mentioned herein are the property of their respective owner.